You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind, episode number 14. You fail only if you stop writing. Ray Bradbury.
Have you ever wondered what it's like inside a screenwriter's mind? In this podcast, we explore how successful screenwriters tackle structure, plot, character, dialogue, and the film business. Get ready to go down the rabbit hole of story. Let's travel inside the screenwriter's mind with your guide, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome to another episode of Inside the Screenwriter's Mind. I am your guide, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is brought to you by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie's going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And guys, I have a special treat for you. If you are interested in getting a three-part video series on screenwriting and how to write blockbusters in Hollywood today by some Oscar winners, some multi-billion dollar screenwriters, all you got to do is head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/free-video-series. Now, today we go inside the mind of screenwriter Randall Jansen. Now, Randall is the writer of The Doors, Mask of Zorro, and he worked on Tales from the Crypt, HBO, legendary HBO series, among many other projects in the course of his amazing career. Now, the interview with Randall originally aired on the Film Trooper podcast, and Scott over there did an amazing in-depth interview with Randall that spans 5 episodes, and we're talking about hours of conversation. So this is the definition of inside a screenwriter's mind, without question. So for the next few episodes of this podcast, we will be going inside the mind of Randall Jansen.
Probably the main reason I started this podcast was I was excited. I was hoping to get you as like my first guest. So it's been a long time coming just to get you to be part of it.
My tricky schedule, very, very, very busy. You had to go through my agent, countless calls.
Definitely got you there. So cheers.
Cheers.
Like you said, we are at the Highland Stillhouse in Oregon City.
Correct.
Oregon City used to be the original capital of Oregon before they moved to Salem. But Oregon City, was it sort of the last city or the city established at the end of the Oregon Trail? Was that it?
That is correct. And it was also auspicious in that it was settled by a guy who bailed out of the Hudson's Bay Company in the fur trade, Dr. John McLaughlin, and settled down and put a trading post right at the foot of the Willamette River Falls here, which was the site of a magnificent Native American metropolis and had been for probably thousands of years. And he just came and planted his trading post right there in the midst of it.
Really?
And took a Native American woman for a wife, I believe. his story is one of the things that's on my list to really read about, but it's a fascinating story. But this was back in the 1840s, I believe.
I mean, when I think about it, it's like, what was the Oregon Trail? Was early 1800s, wasn't it?
Yeah, it started in the 1840s. You know, once Oregon, the Oregon Territory was established, and the word got out of the very fertile farmland,
right,
the potential of it, it started creating the migration west.
You know, it's funny. I went on a field trip with my daughter. They went to the Foster Farms over in Oregon City. It was one of the first like farms outposts for all the pioneers coming in from the Oregon Trail.
Yeah.
And Foster, he was successful starting up like a general store in Boston or something like that. And once he saw that Oregon Territory was opening up, he decided not to take the Oregon Trail. He took a ship with his family, and he took his business and decided to open up another store over here in Oregon. But he took the route of going down the Atlantic, all the way down past the tip of Chile, you know, down there in the Pacific, coming all the way up the Pacific. So he took that route all the way instead of taking the wagon train.
Yeah.
And so he established
an option.
So he established the farm and like the outposts of where people came through Hood. Mountain Hood.
Right.
So, and they would help actually carve out some roads and passages, because when the pioneers came to Oregon, either they were going to take the Columbia River all the way, you know, down, or some would try to get through Mountain Hood.
Mm-hmm.
So those who try to venture and get through Mountain Hood, they had to, they got stuck or something like that. So Foster and his people end up, you know, helping out a lot of pioneers and developing a road there.
Mm-hmm.
So he had this outpost, and he had the general store there. He had the farm. He had like a little, you know, lodges or inns, you know, where people could stay. So it was like, mm-hmm. it was the first site of civilization for a lot of pioneers after his long journey.
Wow.
And he just made a killing.
Yeah.
And so they have this farm that you can go to.
Huh.
It's an educational farm, but it's still, we're walking through the house, you know, seeing the stuff they use, seeing the farm, seeing the barn. And it was just,
that's neat.
It allowed all the kids to, like, you know, really hands-on experience what it would have been like as a pioneer in the Oregon Trail.
Wow.
So it was a little bit of history that I had no idea about.
Sure.
But I was like, wow, that's pretty cool.
Sure.
But
they have a museum over here for the Oregon Trail Museum, which I believe has been shut down now because of lack of funding, because of the budget cuts and everything else. But that was one of the things. I've been amused, actually, since I moved up here from California, that that with the Oregon Trail, that was the overland route that a lot of people who were heading to the California Gold Rush took.
Oh, really?
You know? Yeah. And so at one point, you know, you have the trail diverts, you know, and you go to California and search for gold, or you go to Oregon and grow things, you know. And I think that was a very interesting dichotomy there of where, you know, it really underscores the differences between California and Oregon now that I look at it.
Isn't that funny? Because that's sort of the what exists today.
Well, that's my point,
yeah.
Exactly.
So I'm a little slow today.
That's all right, Scott. We'll just have another beer there and you'll catch up.
That was a great segue. So one of the things I wanted to do with you is, like, one of my favorite podcasts is the Creative Screenwriting podcast hosted by Jeff Goldsmith.
Mm-hmm.
And he's now since left as senior editor of Creative Screenwriting Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And he started his own podcast called Q&A, Question and Answer with Jeff Goldsmith, because he's been really instrumental in holding these free screenings down in Los Angeles of just different movies. And at the end of every movie, he would have the screenwriters there to like talk for like an hour and a half about the movie, their experience, and all that kind of stuff.
Wow, what a concept! Actually, having the writer.
Oh, I know, and he's great, and I really enjoy like his style of interviewing, and you know, and I can tell like sometimes he's polite to like some of the people or some of the work that they've done, but inside I could tell like that comic book geek in him wants to go, what were you thinking? You know, that kind of thing. But he's still very cordial about it.
Sure.
He actually happened to be in college a roommate of Dave Jaffe. Dave Jaffe was the creator of God of War and some of the Twisted Metal series, who I worked with at Sony for many years. So when I met up with Jeff, you know, I introduced myself via that way. So
right.
He was very cool, but he's very busy. And again, for anybody who wants to check out his stuff, definitely check out Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith or some of the past stuff on Creative Screenwriting Magazine. But anyway, this is my chance to do my really horrible impersonation of Jeff interviewing you, Randall, as if like we just finished a screening and
oh, okay.
you know, and we had this big audience, but right now we're just we have this cool little pub. It's funny because, side note, is I normally do my podcast down at Mars Irish Pub.
And right. Yeah. Like, I was going to suggest that for you as well. Yeah.
So we go there every other week, my buddy Frederick and I, and we go down and he knows everybody there. And so we're regulars there every other Monday night.
Okay.
But it's funny that it's an Irish pub, and here we are across the way in Oregon City in a Scottish Irish pub again. So
they will tell you it's a Scottish pub. There won't be. There's not much in it. Not much Irish here.
Okay, good.
You know. Although I do see the Bank of Ireland. Framed over there. You know, but if they had a choice, it would be. You know, basically, it's anti-English.
And it's charming. I mean, both places are just charming in this like old style bar. So anybody who gets up here, you got to check out these places.
Yeah.
So we have Mars Irish Pub and Ello.
Yeah.
And we have the Highland
Still House
here in Oregon City.
Yeah, which if you're a fan of single malt scotches, this has one of the best collections you will find anywhere, in arguably even on the entire West Coast. So this the Mick and his wife who own the place are huge Scotch files, and they're just
I have to learn more about this.
Yeah,
I had this innate desire to want to get into.
Scotch. Well, there's part of it. I honeymooned in Scotland, and so that's where That's where I started, you know, acquiring the taste. And so it was
more of a, you were acquiring. You weren't just because now you were married. You were just drinking more.
I come up for excuses to drink more. You know,
I started drinking. I used to never drink until my daughter was born.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
I started to drink and drink a lot more.
Yeah. It weighs upon you heavily.
So anyway.
Being the parent.
So I wanted to – the first question that Jeff always asks is he always wants to know breaking in stories of like how you got started in the business or what was your first paying job or how you broke in.
Well, I went to film school at UCLA, and at that time, I entered the film school there in 1979, and you were basically thrown into a little life raft with a bunch of other people that had the same aspirations to either be a writer, director, working in the film industry in one way or another.
Bums real quick. Was that time, the late 70s, like, because I know that...
This is the very late 70s, 79, I started.
But I was wondering if, like, the early 80s, was it... I can't remember, was there a golden age of, like, where everybody wanted to go to film school? Because I know that there was a kind of a... something in the 60s.
The film school sort of bonanza occurred in the... I would say probably the mid 70s.
Okay.
And carried on all through into the early 80s. And that was basically because George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Ron Howard, they were all products of film school.
Right.
You know, Francis Coppola, of course.
De Palma,
you know,
all those guys, right.
Yeah. And Scorsese.
Yes, and NYU.
NYU, of course. Right. And that was it. I mean, basically, we just covered the film school landscape at that time. There was three places to go: USC, UCLA, and NYU.
Right.
And for me, I had grown up in the San Diego area, and I couldn't afford going to SC, and NYU was just about as far removed from a Southern California beach as possible. And I used to go with my dad, who worked for the UC system, up to see basketball games at UCLA when John Wooden was coaching there. So that was sort of the natural place to go to. And it was vastly cheaper than SC.
Right,
And actually what I liked about SC, there were differences in the curriculum at that time, too, which was that if you wanted to be if you had a very specific idea of what you wanted to do in the film industry, whether you wanted to be a sound editor or an editor or a cinematographer or a director, producer, whatever, you would go to SC because they had very clear tracks on each of those specific professions.
Yeah.
UCLA, it was much looser, and they were kind of had this had sort of the stigma, if you will, of creating auteurs. You know, you were the complete filmmaker in a sense once you came out of UCLA. But the difference, another difference was, is that you had to fund all your own stuff after the basic Super 8 class that occurred when you first entered school. SC, it didn't happen. You had to they funded the advanced projects, but you had to compete with other people to get that one or two directing positions that they would do. Anyone could be a director at UCLA if you had the money for it, which to me, it was really like the real world.
Exactly.
Much more like the real world.
Didn't Coppola come to UCLA?
Yeah, Coppola came to UCLA. Jim Morrison and Ray Manzarek of The Doors were there.
Oh, okay.
You know, that was in the early 60s.
That's right.
You know, but I mean, there's, you know, Paul, names. I knew this would happen. The names start fading, you know, from me. Who wrote Taxi Driver?
Schrader, right?
Paul Schrader. Right. Thank you. Went to UCLA. You know, I mean, the list of names is very long and prominent
that
UCLA has produced, and SC as well. So,
do you know, when I went to UCSD, and I was looking around. I went to junior college first. Went to Palomar College,
right?
And the only claim to fame we had there was that Phil Tippett was a famous visual effects artist from the Star Wars films, and his, you know, all his stop motion.
I interviewed Phil when I wrote for the Carlsbad Journal back in 1976.
Oh, okay, so you know, okay, great, right. So his claim to fame was that he went to that school.
Right.
So it was great, you know, 2 year school. You get out, then you could transfer anywhere. And then I didn't know where to go exactly. I looked at San Francisco State, I looked at USC, I looked at UCLA. For some reason, I decided of all places to go UCSD, which probably wasn't the best choice of film school, but I don't know. It was nearby.
and near a beach.
Near a beach, definitely. So the funny thing was I spent a lot more time when I was there, because the way they had the film track was that everything was really dedicated towards the graduate film students.
Right.
As an undergrad, you didn't really get a chance to get too hands-on. Knowing that now, I probably should have gone to maybe like San Diego State, which is much more of a vocational approach to the education. But I spent a lot of time with this graduate film student from UCLA who was doing her thesis or her work down in UCSD. So she had access to all the, you know, the editing bays, the rooms, and she's trying to finish her thesis. And she just needed an assistant. So I was there, and I got all this hands-on training of how to, like, you know, cut film and, you know, put all this stuff together. Yeah. And then I would go up with her on a regular basis to UCLA, and just, I was crashing courses. I didn't even go to this school, but I was at UCLA just sitting in at the film courses. So kind of give me a different perspective of things. But anyway, that's my UCLA connection.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. Well, at that time, again, this is in the late 70s, you know, those were the three places to go. Now the landscape is vastly different. Almost every college has a film department or media department, something like that. So, I mean, that just shows you how things have changed. Anyway, I went through the film program, and at UCLA at that time, they didn't have there was no difference between the undergrad and the graduate programs.
Nice. Those days.
Those days. Literally in my second year there, the graduate students rebelled and staged a little demonstration and really forced the hand of the school to alter the curriculum in a sense to favor grad students, because basically, and I think they had a legitimate beef. They were competing with, you know, freshmen who were new to the department for, you know, the limited amount of materials and cameras and things that we had to do their graduate films.
Right.
And so, which really wasn't fair. So they did an overhaul of the curriculum they didn't do it overnight. It actually happened right after I graduated. So basically, I benefited from having, you know, basically had a graduate education. As an undergrad.
Oh, okay.
Because I stuck it out and went an extra year as an undergrad.
Right. So I suffered later.
Yeah. Okay. And then they kicked me out and said, it's time for you to move on.
Because
I had maxed out every unit possible. But knowing that, I took every writing class I wanted to. When I first got in there, I was hoping to be a director. That was my aspiration.
Oh, okay.
Like everybody else. That's what I wanted to do.
That's what I was going to ask you.
But so. you had to fund your own films, and I didn't have that kind of money, so I realized that, well, typing paper was cheap at that point, and I said, well, shoot, I'm going to write, and I'm going to direct my movies on paper, and then eventually, if I get enough clout, I will be able to direct something that I write myself. So that was the philosophy. That hasn't happened, right, by the way, but it has happened for a lot of people that I know.
Now you wrote.
Yeah, so
you were a writer when you were younger too. Like you wrote
well,
for paper as a.
Yeah, I mean, I was. I started writing like as soon as I learned to write. You know, I just was. I had kind of spates where I was very prolific. Third grade, especially. Seventh grade was also a big one. but I initially wanted to be a journalist. I actually wanted to be Cameron Crowe because I loved Rolling Stone and loved music still when I was in high school. That's what I was aspiring to be, was to be like a music journalist,
right,
of some sort. There was a great writer for Rolling Stone at that point. I think he's back now writing some stuff for them again, but named Charles M. Young, who did just some fantastic interviews with like the Sex Pistols and Kiss. And I still have those issues because the writing is just so funny and insightful and really great, and just inspired me a great deal to be, and this was the era too where Tom Wolfe was doing Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test on the heels of that, kind of what is known as the new journalism.
Okay.
Where it wasn't real cut and dry, but actually there was a great deal of reportage going on and quasi-sermonizing that would be worked in by the likes of Charles M. Young or, our Gonzo Hunter Thompson,
right,
kind of,
right,
you know, people of that sort. It was an interesting time to be in journalism. And then I wanted to be a freelance magazine writer, I thought.
Yeah.
You know? And then I realized I probably really couldn't make a whole lot of money at it. But I had started working for my hometown newspaper in Carlsbad, California, writing sports for them. And then in the summertime when I was out of high school, it worked into full-time work where I was doing feature articles. So I was interviewing surfers and runners. And Carlsbad was also the site of a motocross scene out there, and doing some reporting on that. It was very interesting. And I learned how to interview people at an early age, which was a great thing. Then I knew that I wanted to continue with writing of some sort, but in my studies at school, but I just wasn't sure what kind it was. So I too went to a community college, MiraCosta.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Just because I was working at the newspaper still, and I was getting experience there part-time, and I thought, well, I'll get a couple more years there experience and then take classes and get my basic education out of the way, and then by that time maybe I'll know what to do. And I happened to take a playwriting course, and that was very interesting. That opened up my eyes to dramatic writing, and I realized that playwriting wasn't quite it for me, but screenwriting, ooh, that sounded very avant-garde and very cool. So
do you recall maybe like one of the first moments that you like wrote a piece or a paragraph or something there somebody else wrote, and you were able to witness sort of a positive sort of emotional response from it? Or is this like a one moment, like you wrote something where maybe you felt good about it, or somebody else's reaction to it was surprising, but it you know what I mean? It's just like it made you want to keep going, or want more of that, or feedback on that.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I wrote three scripts when I was at UCLA, three full-length scripts, and they were pretty abysmal. but my instructors were very supportive. Mm-hmm. I got A's on them.
Okay.
Yes, that's right for here. Thank you.
What do they call Scottish eggs?
Yeah, the Scotch eggs.
Scotch eggs.
Yeah.
Yummy.
And that was initially, I think, be studying and doing that, to get that kind of thumbs up from them was very positive.
Okay.
You know, that made a big impression on me. And then once I got out of school, to have some peers of mine to just kind of comment. There's mustard right there you can dip
it
into. That was positive. But nothing was as strong as getting the kind of the endorsement of a true professional, somebody working in the business. God, I just mangled this one. This
you made it a stuff. Masher?
Yeah, it's all right. There we go.
Mm. Yeah, it's good.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It's funny. I'm getting my train of thought right now. This is really delicious.
I know. So.
I'm sorry, we can keep. Don't worry about this. I pause, cut this out.
Okay.
This is good.
I know.
Don't I mean this. I mean, this is like your interview.
Oh.
So it's like, and the food. Oh, yummy.
Oh, yeah. There's more mustard right there.
Yeah, I got some on this side.
Yeah, so it's an egg. It's wrapped in sausage and deep fried.
Mm.
It's really healthy.
So is it a boiled egg first, and then they put it into, like, a sausage, and they have to fry that?
I think so, yeah.
Mm.
No.
I love it. This beer I'm drinking.
You know,
this is yummy.
It's a great place to be in anytime, but I love coming here on a when it's howling wind out and cold.
There you go.
You know, and
well, this place is located right by the river.
Right. This is out the falls.
Yeah. This is the fall. Like, is it the Willamette Falls?
Yeah, Willamette.
Right. So it definitely has a propensity for the wind and the weather change. So.
Mm-hmm. Before the paper mill was shut down, certain fumes wafting up from the mill would sort of sweeten things. And I mean that facetiously.
So can you recall let me backtrack. Do you recall one movie experience you had where you thought to yourself that you were like moved or inspired to say, yeah, I want more of this? Or like for me as a kid, I remember, you know, movies were just always sort of part of just growing up. But the first time I remember seeing sort of more mature, non sort of spectacle movie, you know, that I realized was different than what I had seen before, was when my parents, I think, took me to see Amadeus.
Oh.
You know, so I was floored by that movie because I thought to myself, I just went through something that I never thought I would be entertained by. Because I thought it had to have, like, you know, laser guns or cowboys or Indians or aliens or spaceships or explosions. Because that's, you know, that was my appetite.
Yeah.
I was second nature. But once I was introduced to a film that had none of that, but engaged and captured my interest, it definitely changed something in me. As well as another film that I wasn't expecting to was Somewhere in Time with Christopher Reeve. Because I was just thinking, it's Superman. But to me, I was like, what was that? And that got to me. And so I remember those two films, of all films, that sort of changed my perspective And then I remember having, when I got into college, I wasn't thinking about film. I was thinking about studying illustration and art. I went there for that, but then got sort of the film bug myself and came across, I had to take a script writing class. It was very, very cheesy, but I remember going to the library at the time. This is before the internet. You actually had to go to the library.
Oh, yeah.
Check out the reference books.
Yep.
And they had real scripts. And I remember reading Ordinary People. And I'd never seen the film. I just read the screenplay. And I remember just, it was just turning the page after turning the page because I just had to get through it. But just having that first experience of absorbing what a script looks like, and I didn't know what all the little things meant. You know, what is INT, XT, all that kind of stuff. We started beginning to figure out the little code or the language. But I remember having that significant moment as well, coming out of that going, what did I just read? What did I just experience? I wanted to ask you, did you have anything like that?
Well, I did as a kid. Going way back. And I really would have to say that I didn't know the impact that it had on me at the time, obviously. But it's really almost now that I look back on those times. Now I understand why I was so moved and influenced by. And this is, it goes back to when we first moved to California, and my parents were running a beachfront motel in Oceanside called the Buccaneer, which was
at
Buccaneer Beach, in Oceanside. And it had all these pirate motifs and everything like that. So my first 5 years in California after moving from Utah to we're here at the Buccaneer Motel with all the pirate motifs running around there. And I used to, run around there and have a lot of fun and meet a lot of different people that were staying there. But they would always, on the weekends, we would go, my parents would take a break because we lived on the premises. Mm-hmm. There was no escape from it. My parents would go to a drive-in movie out in Oceanside. And
it's an airfield now.
Yeah, it is. And the ritual was basically they would pop their own popcorn ahead of time, put it into a big brown paper market sack, and they would take a cooler full of Cragmont sodas, and they would put me in PJs. I had two older brothers who were 10 and 12 years older than me, so they were teenagers by this time. They didn't want to have anything to do with that, so they would just stay at home. But I would go with my parents with them to the drive-in, and then I would be in my PJs, and they would always hope that I would fall asleep in the back seat. At least that was the plan while they watched these, sometimes very adult movies. And lo and behold, I never fell asleep once because I was so intrigued by what I was seeing. And I can tell you exactly what I saw. I saw Bonnie and Clyde.
Whoa, they took that?
Yeah, well, I think they had intended that I'd fallen asleep. They had no idea. They were not film savvy at all. They were probably didn't have any idea what they were in store for. I recall very clearly the opening frames of that, where you see the naked Faye Dunaway and her butt up there on that big screen. And my eyes got really wide, going, "Wow, this is wild!" And I was just riveted from that point.
And then it ends in a great bloody bath, at that time was.
Oh, I mean, I can still recall being in the back seat and seeing my parents visibly recoil from after they make the one robbery, and the guy comes out and stands in front of the car and tries to he's got some kind of a weapon at him, but they run him down and he ends up hitting the windshield and falling off it. My parents just like, wow, kind of gasping over the violence of that. And I was like, wow. So Bonnie and Clyde. I saw Bonnie and Clyde. I saw In the Heat of the Night. Guess Who's Coming to Dinner?
Wow.
To Sir with Love. Patton with my dad. Planet of the Apes. Then my dad and I started going and seeing some of these original. My mom stayed at home for some reason. I don't think she wanted to see Patton, but my dad did. And I saw Planet of the Apes with him. And these now these are the films that I actually hearken to my students nowadays in teaching, because I think this was a fantastic age of American filmmaking. It was really from about 66 to about 76, that 10-year period produced just astonishingly great American films.
And it was made by the studios.
Isn't
that crazy at the time?
Yeah.
Thinking about that.
And ultimately what killed it, of course, was Jaws.
Right.
And
the Blockbuster.
You know, and Blockbuster. From that point on, it changed everything in how the studio started doing things.
Tentpole spectacle films.
And
right.
Again, not to take away from the Spielbergs of the world,
right.
and the geeks, you know, the film school geeks, which who basically started running the business at that point, which was great. But you know, prior to that, we still had the Godfathers and The Conversation and Chinatown and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Five Easy Pieces and The Last Detail, the Hal Ashby's Harold and Maude, you know, making these kinds of movies. And there was just nothing like it.
Right.
You know, so Little Big Man, these are films that I think still really resonate today hugely. And the studios have sort of lost sight of that, you know, because they were really socially conscious in a lot of ways. They pushed the envelope, you know. And the subject matter was truly adult. The notion of catering to
demographics,
the pubescent a boy, and action figures and all of that, unheard of. No way.
Right.
No, you didn't do that. It was still in the days where you had people like Robert Evans, who was running, Paramount. Apparently, in between
his
yeah, that
well documented.
he still was somebody who had gut instincts, you know, and could do things that and greenlit stuff that you know that we'll never see. You haven't seen stuff like that. You can. The only way to find it now is, you know, in the independent realms.
What do you think about? There's this sort of a article I read a couple of years ago about how like HBO and Showtime, all these the cable network or pay per view and the cable channels are now providing that sort of fix for adult drama that where the movies. Theatrical movies have just become, like I said, tentpole spectacles.
Yeah.
Either of, you know,
the Avatars,
fantasy, the sci-fi genre, or whatever it is, or comedies that are, you know, the gross out or R-rated,
right.
Or whatnot comedies. I mean, you have a little sprinkle of independent films, but the canvas of what's going on the television spectrum right now, where you have long form, where you can develop a character in a long, you know, a much slower pace and more in depth, is why you're seeing like the success of like The Sopranos and Mad Men and all these things.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether or not that sort of fulfilled the niche or the need that once was supplied during the late 60s, mid 60s, in the 70s for what the studios were supplying. You know what I mean? Now it's just got fragmented. I don't know. That's sort of
I mean nowadays everything has gotten fragmented. It's really broken down. I mean once we entered the digital age,
right,
everything became fragmented, and that's what digitizing analog does. You know, it breaks things down into these little
bits.
These little bits, you know, this whether it's a sound bite or it's a, you know, it's a bit of information, and that's sort of its job in one way. So we've lost a lot, you know,
right.
in that at the same time, you know, it's just changed. These are this is part of a larger conversation that we'll get into here, that the benefits and the curses of the digital world now and digital culture. But in answer to your question, I would say yes, indeed. HBO, Showtime, AMC running Mad Men and stuff, they are filling a niche now where so many of us have a thirst for those great adult dramas,
right?
You know,
right.
That deal with touchy, material. It's not necessarily high concept material, but it's really important material.
Right.
You know, I mean, for example, HBO recently doing the You Don't Know Jack, you know, the Jack Kevorkian story. I knew nothing really about Kevorkian other than just seeing the headlines always about him from that. But, you know, Pacino really owned that role, and Barry Levinson, you know, came in and directed it, and it was a really compelling piece of work. But there was no way a studio would make that movie. It would have to be HBO, and of course HBO loves to flaunt the fact that only HBO can do it, you know. And so I think it's great. But, you know, again, HBO is part of a larger conglomerate mega monster that they, too, have to answer to someone.
Right.
if not only their ratings. But, you know, it's a corporation. And so, you know, to find truly independent stuff, you might have to even go further out into the margins. But comparatively, still to the main studios and the three major networks that we're used to, it's still pretty very controversial and exciting stuff.
Right.
They do. So
let me get back to, do you remember like the first time you read a finished script that got you like turned on, like, oh, I can do this?
Well, I don't necessarily recall reading a script and going gaga over it. I recall seeing movies and going just like, oh crap, that's what I want to write. That's, you know, and that's what I want to do. So we have to remember, you know, as a screenplay is only a stepping stone to the final piece of art, you know, that it is. And it's hard to admit that as writers, but we do have to remind ourselves, if you're a screenwriter, that it's a way station to the ultimate, the final product, the ultimate vision. Okay. So again, I would look at a script and I was like, okay, all right, that's okay. But it's the movie that really inspired me. And it's still the movies that really inspire me now. I don't get overly excited about reading scripts per se. I want to see the movie. So great movies make me want to write great scripts. But it's always interesting and instructive to look at the scripts that have become great movies.
Right.
And to see that they are not perfect. That sometimes they're far from it.
Right.
For example, well, whenever you let's say you go to a bookstore and you'll find the screenplay of a certain movie that's been published now. It's usually the shooting script that they'll publish, you know, and so they'll have scene numbers and everything like
exactly.
that. Anytime there are scene numbers on there, you know, that's a very late draft. It's something that they probably, you know, it was the shooting draft or close to it if they were numbering scenes. Years ago, Frank Darabont, who wrote and directed The Shawshank Redemption, published a version of Shawshank that was not the shooting draft. It was a book that I think included the early draft of the script and then the shooting draft, something like that. And I'm mad at myself for I never picked that up and bought it, but I remember thumbing through it. But Frank had the courage to go ahead and print an earlier draft of it. And the thing was a mess. It was all, there was a full of strikeouts and crossed out stuff and notes in the margins and things like that. And that's what a real script looks like.
Right.
You know, so beware to anyone out there who's considering writing scripts and they think that it has to be all perfect. That's just not the case. You know, a screenplay is, it cannot be chiseled in stone. It really can't. It has, it is a living, breathing entity, and it will ebb ebb and flow. It will inhale. It will exhale. It will do things you don't expect. Sometimes you have to make alterations due to weather, to cranky actors, to the whims of a studio or a star or director or whatever, for good or for worse or whatever. These are just the things that it's constantly in a state of flux and will be until the film is shot, edited, and screened before a paying audience. You know, that's the way it is. And you have to understand that. So you can't be overly precious with it.
Right.
You know, and just think, I mean, if you're starting out and you're trying to write a great writing sample, of course you want to make it as good as you can possibly be, because you want to get your best foot forward and you want to show people what you're capable of.
Right.
But once you are working and or in that business, you have to know, you have to suck it up, man, and just know that this thing is going to get mangled and trundled under by the Hollywood machine sometimes. And even in the independent realms, it doesn't matter, because there was still things are going to be constantly changing, because the universe is just throwing you change-ups all the time. You know, okay, it's raining. We're supposed to shoot a sunny a scene under sun today in blazing heat. Okay, the bar is more crowded than we expected to have our, you know, scene.
Podcast, where we're gonna, that's all good.
You know, I mean,
these are great mics.
You know, I mean, these are things where you just constantly, you have to think on your feet and you have to be sort of flexible in terms of, so as storytellers too, you have to have the acuity of mind, the flexibility to say, okay, that doesn't work. I can switch this. I can do it here, and probably shuffle this around, and we'll make that work. And
right.
Boom, and we'll fit it for the occasion.
When you write, do you feel like sometimes I've heard the expression or heard things where sometimes writers discover the story, like it's sitting up there in a cloud of years or of moments of inspiration that are just sort of permeating where they start picking it up, like it just starts trickling down, and they start, you know, like almost invisible ink, like it starts revealing itself, the story and the shape that, even though your intention might not have been there originally,
right,
but as it, like you said, ebbs and flows and evolves, you're discovering it. And it's almost as you just have to be in the right sort of mental space or capacity to grab hold of it and sort of let it, let it evolve.
Yeah.
And I don't know if... Oh, this is good. Yeah, I'm good. This is good stuff. Thanks. So I was wondering if... So you're in college. You were taking the screenwriting class, I guess,
right,
and getting feedback from your professors.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, like, sort of the first permeation of, like, the germ of the idea for your first full-length story that you were like, you know what? This would make a good movie, and I think I got a, you know, you've heard writers, or what's that term? I got a beat on it.
Right,
I got a beat
right
on it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's, you bring up a couple of points, but just specifically to me, as I mentioned before, when I was at UCLA, I wrote three scripts that were completely uncommercial. They were just, they were bad. You know, I wrote a, you know, sprawling period piece and a couple other just not good, you know, pieces of work. And then I graduated and I knew that I had to, in order to get somewhere, you know, to get ahead in the business, I had to make a conscious effort to write something commercial, you know, just to get on the map.
Right.
I can be artful and write arty movies later on, you know, but I really need to get on the map first and get try to make a living at it. Because at that point, I was I was working in the mailroom of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences, and I, you know, I just which was a great job actually, but because it allowed me a lot of time to write during the day. But yeah, I had to I couldn't stay there for the rest of my life.
Right.
So, so I said, okay, I'm going to write something commercial and write something that could actually get made, you know, for a relatively low sum of money. So at that time, which that translated to write a horror film.
Right.
Okay. So then, well, okay, how do you write a horror film? Or even at that time, it's like, oh, God, everything's been done already. Right.
Right. You
know? So I was really looking to do something different. And so what I wrote a script in that summer called Slaughter Alley, which was about a haunted highway or a stretch of road, of rural road that was haunted by the ghost of a hot rodder who had been killed on it back in 1962.
Right.
And so he races up and down it in the middle of the night in his 57 Chevy Bel Air, you know, running people off the road and claiming souls. And
yeah. I mean, as you're explaining this, I can completely hear the twangy guitar right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, it was. Link Ray, you know, the Cramps. I mean, it was very music inspired in that sense because it, you know, just like those great big Detroit Steel iconic cars, you know, from the late 50s and 60s, all the muscle car era and stuff. You hear that big guitar sound as well, the Ventures and, you know, all those Eddie Cochran and all these the rockabilly sound and stuff.
Is it Eddie Rebels? No, Eddie, they did Rebel Rouser, or he was just a guitar artist.
But
Eddie something. But anyway, almost like a more of a punk version of that.
Well, what was interesting, simultaneous with this for me, was that I was in L.A., staying in L.A. after I graduated, and was really caught up in the music scene in Los Angeles at that point, which was getting swept with a real renaissance of music. But it was the punk rock thing that was at the core of it, and the hardcore specifically was taking over and really having a profound influence on everything. It was basically taking a flamethrower to everything.
Right, right.
And just burning it down. So you had, and that was led by Black Flag and the Descendants and...
which are still relevant today.
Oh, sure,
still
sure.
Running.
You know, and the Dead Kennedys up in San Francisco.
Right.
And, there was Social D down in Orange County.
Jeez,
and stuff.
Southern California punk scene, right?
Yeah. And to me, it had a huge influence on me on a number of levels, specifically, you know, just creatively how you attack things. And they strip it down. There was no pretension. You just went out and you did it and you made it work. And you did it with passion and really with an attitude. And there was just something elementally bitchin' about it.
You know?
And, man, it just was incredible. So I was witnessing a lot of this. And then at the same time, with the hardcore stuff, there was the sort of the art damaged bands that were doing things like this. There were bands like Savage Republic and the Fibonacci's and Wall of Voodoo, even, that were heavily influenced by film.
Right.
And so they were doing a lot of like soundtrack stuff. Wall of Voodoo used to do a medley of Sergio Leone movies, soundtracks, so, you know, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly, and Hang 'em High. They would do this in concert, and it was just like, wow. And that had that big twangy guitar, and it was just like, wow, this is really, really
now
amazing
you,
stuff.
Speaking of Wall of Voodoo, you. The lead, the front man for
Stan Ridgway. Yeah.
Now, did you become friends with him working on a project?
Yeah.
Or because-
well, just a quick aside there. I was, after I wrote Slaughter Alley, I wanted to write a murder mystery. And what I was doing, my notion for it was to have, it was a murder mystery that was set in the punk rock underground of L.A. And it was about a hardcore kid who was accused of killing someone and who had been apprehended. And then his public defender was like a hippie, a liberal hippie who had to, you know, defend this kid. And they were, I was very interested in just the opposing sensibilities kind of thing, you know. And so I started doing all this quote unquote research, you know, in the music scene at the time, and going to see all these different shows, and I made contact with a number of bands. I just reached out to them and one time or another and say, hey, could I'm doing this, would you mind if I come to a rehearsal and see what you guys do and everything? And everybody was really cool, you know. The Minutemen was one of those bands and stuff. And so the script didn't pan out. I just just never quite got over the hump for it. I made all these contacts with all these bands and had very good friends. And so that's what led then to doing some music videos for them and whatever. One of the bands that were very welcoming to me was a band called the Fibonaccis. And the Fibonaccis had Artie Farty and Ready to Party, as the LA Weekly described them. The Fibonaccis were open for Walla Voodoo at one time, and they knew Stan Ridgway very much. And so one time I was at Club Lingerie, and I forget who was playing, but it wasn't the Fibs, but I was with the keyboardist of the Fibs, John Dentino, and Stan Ridgway and his wife came in, and I said, oh God, you know, John, can you introduce me to Stan? I said, I'm a big fan, and I really loved, the first time I saw them on stage, I was just like, oh wow, these guys just completely, especially Stan, just captured a lot how my that sort of eclectic approach to anything and everything. And he said, sure. So I met Stan and we talked, and I told him, Walla Voodoo was actually a big influence in writing Slaughter Alley for him. And he said, oh, send me the script. I'd love to, you know, love to read it. And I said, okay. So I did, and a couple weeks later, I got a postcard. He actually mailed me a postcard and said, I read your script. I really like it. I'm going to call you in a couple of days with a plan. Stan is always scheming. He's always got something working up with a plan. But basically, that started a friendship that still continues today.
That's so cool.
And ironically, his manager, eventual manager, when he went solo, was my wife's older brother. But I, even before I started dating her, I knew Chris, but I didn't know he was related to Kate when we first met. It was just
crazy.
Really. So Stan and Chris, they both argue. They like to take credit for introducing us.
Interesting.
Together,
you're like, but it sounds like it was just already in the
It was already in the,
in
works.
The works.
It was
right.
a pretty, yeah, yeah. But I was going to add one of the things that intrigued me about the music scene at that time, especially in the rockabilly circle that see, is that when the Blasters were playing, and there were
a name I haven't heard in a while.
Yeah,
okay.
There were a number of bands that were, you know, there was the Stray Cats that were the real big commercial.
They kind of broke out, but there were some other.
But the Blasters
ones.
Were the big, the ones in the L.A. scene. But there were some other. Los Lobos was really kind of a rockabilly influence and all that. But anyway, they would bring out these crowds that you would see them come up and they pull up and they're vintage cars, and these guys would come out in their pompadours and their jeans and t-shirt and their cuffed jeans and their cowboy boots or whatever, and then they would have their girlfriends in the poodle skirts and the Betty Page kind of, you know, hair and all of
it's
that.
It's funny because that scene is like, it's an like a greaser scene, but like the poodle skirts. Like you said, it's not like a Happy Days cutie. It's a little bit the edgier.
It was a
Betty Page with it. Now it's like tattoos everywhere. Right.
Granted, it was a little edgier then, but it still struck me. I was still rather amused by it because to me they still struck me as kind of like the posers, you know, because there had been the real guys. That's me. Thank you.
Okay, hey, we're back. We just took a little dinner break. But listen, we were talking about Slaughter Alley.
Right.
Which, by the way, so it was like one of your first scripts.
Yes. This is my first attempt to write something commercial, yes.
But that story is dear to your heart because we've been working on a little bit launching your site, slaughteralley.com.
Correct.
Now, just to let you know, I'm going to take another crack at that map, I think, because I've learned since we met last year, I've learned so much about like how to, you know, make some websites, how to do just my job recently. I've just been working in Flash lately. So, all this other stuff, I'm like, oh my gosh, I think I can go back and like fix what I kind of attempt to do. But anyway, that's in the back burner. But one of these days, as things get cleared up, I think I have a way that I can make that thing launch.
Oh, that's great. That's great.
But again, that's just my interest of like learning stuff like that. And it, each year I get more and more knowledge, and it's like, oh, wait, I can apply this now.
So, sure, sure.
Anyway, so you write Slatter Alley.
Right.
And you had two other ones. Now, during the process of like writing these scripts, and you were trying to make it something commercially viable, was there any moments in there where you felt like, I don't know, like you felt your groove? Like, I know that sometimes I write stuff, like, it's a lot of times it's painful, but sometimes you get these magic moments where you just feel like when it's completed or something, or you're like, wow, you know, I did it, or I could see this, or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, the question is, where do you find your enjoyment in the writing? Because if you've done it so long, obviously there must be some grain of...
Well, Slatter Alley was fun to write, and I've done multiple drafts of it over the years. And it looks like I'm going to be doing another one here maybe very soon, because I've got some interest in it yet again. It's the script that refuses to die. This is what I was saying, that, you know, scripts are alive and breathing, and this is some kind of like a monster that just lurks in the primordial slime somewhere, that every now and then somebody keeps coming back to it and saying, wow.
Isn't that like the story of like Lawrence Kasdan, when his one of her early scripts, The Bodyguard, and Costner, you know, saw it on his shelf, something like one of his early scripts, and he said, oh, I'll grab that. And they made that, but it was, you know, things like those stories where they've just been around for so long.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, the lesson I've learned from it is that nothing is ever dead in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. It's just you put it in a drawer for a while, and then, you know, 6 months, a year later, bring it back out and show it around again. That's if it's a spec script, but
right. Well, then again, even that now it's like bled into the actual finished films with what Lucas has done with his Star Wars films.
Yeah.
And I just read somewhere the new Blu-ray release.
Right.
He added some more like dialogue to Darth Vader in Return of the Jedi, where he like screams no, like during the death scene of like the Emperor or something. And so fans are like, again, like, what the hell are you doing?
Wow.
So anyway, so
yeah,
even in a film form, it has life and it breathes. And
sure, sure. Yeah. And that's interesting now that it's come to that, to where it's so easy and accessible to be able to get to make, you know, slight alterations, nip and tucks here and there and all that. I mean, that doesn't surprise me. It goes back to the, I think it was Ezra Pound who said, you know, nothing is, a poem is never finished. It's abandoned. And so I mean, I think that's apropos for any kind of art, you know, you just, including scripts, at some point you just got to abandon it because it's it's never quite done. It will always be a work in progress.
You've got to make a t-shirt of that and have like those ready for like those writer conferences and stuff like that.
Yeah, I never thought of that. That's actually pretty good.
You've seen these like cute like shirts like bustedtees.com or somewhere
right,
that have
right.
some really funny things. But anyway,
yeah.
I think that's a great little saying.
So what like nothing is ever finished, it's like, abandoned on
or
the
just,
back.
It's just something like abandon it. So like this, you know, and they give like the little you know, like a website in the back and something to like t-shirts that are specific to that market
right.
of writers. But
yeah.
People like who want to like walk by and goes, what does that mean, abandon it? Because then it strikes up our conversation, like, you know,
right,
just
sure.
enough, like, what the hell is that term or that phrase means?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
anyway.
That's interesting. Well, anyway, kind of back to the question, was it the inspiration? Or
well, just like when you're working and you have these moments of, like, where you just feel like you're the shit. Like, you're like, you know what I mean? Like, you feel like you're like, oh, my gosh, I'm a genius. But, or sometimes you don't. You know?
Well, I think if you ever start thinking thoughts like that, you're You're really asking for it. You're doomed. You know, that's the day you really start worrying. I really think I had the good fortune one time to meet David Lean, you know, director of Lawrence of Arabia and stuff. And a friend of mine was assisting his restoration of Lawrence of Arabia. And I was she knew that I was a big fan, and she arranged for me to meet him at and sneak in on a screening of it that Spielberg and a few other people were there. And so he came back and shook my hand there afterwards. But she told me later that he had told her this story about when he was directing Lawrence of Arabia, and the day came for him to shoot the scene where very late in the movie where Lawrence is leading the Arabs on the cutting a swath through the Turkish lines and heading straight towards Damascus. And then he has to make a tactical choice of either wipe out and slaughter this Turkish column that had just had raped and pillaged a village, mm-hmm. an Arabic village, or move on to Damascus in greater glory. And the smart tactical thing to do. But Lawrence succumbs to the thing of where he goes and massacres the Turkish column, right, and sort of satiates his need for bloodletting in a way. And Lean told her that the day that they filmed that scene, he drove the limo came and got him at his hotel, and then they drove the hour and a half out to the location or wherever it was. Lean got out of the car and looked at, you know, the hundreds of extras all in uniform and costume, you know, waiting for his first command, you know. And he looked at all these people, cast and crew, just looking at him, and he got struck with diarrhea. Just immediately had to jump back into the car and told the chauffeur, he said, just take me back to the hotel. Took him back to the hotel, and he camped out in the bathroom for 2 or 3 hours, I guess, or whatever. And then finally got enough courage up to go back out to the scene and direct it. But he didn't, the point was, he didn't have any idea how to direct that scene. And he was so struck with fear and insecurity that, you know, he was crapping in his pants. I mean, he just got struck with it. And so he said to my friend Jude that, you know, that just goes to show you, it can hit anyone, anytime.
Right.
You know, it's always when you're putting yourself out there, there's a great risk that you're
right,
taking.
Right.
You're overcoming a great amount of fear there, or you're embracing the fear, you're crossing over, you're taking these big risks and stuff. And so it takes great effort to do it. But he said somebody like, the implication was somebody like him who's got all these accolades and stuff like that, he's sometimes they just don't know how to do it. They're scared. They're scared too, you know?
I am. Thank you.
So I always thought that was a great story. I felt very privileged to have heard that, you know, secondhand.
Right.
You know, and so anyway, back to what we were talking about. The times where you're really starting to feel cocky and think, "Damn, I'm good."
Right, right.
That's where you could be into a little bit of trouble. My best, arguably my best writing is probably stuff that I was mortified that I wrote. You know, that I was scared. I was scared really to pass on because I was afraid of the reaction it would get, that people would just think, what are you thinking? Are you out of your mind? For God's sakes, we're paying you all this money to write this dreck. You know, you pretentious, you know, right, son of a bitch, or, you know, whatever. Art damaged, you know, kind of geek. You know, all these thoughts run through your mind. I mean, it's just, you know, racing. Your mind races with a lot of irrational stuff sometimes. But I think that, and again, fear and insecurity can paralyze you,
right,
when you're working. But the key thing is to have enough of it that it keeps you on edge and it keeps you vigilant and keeps you always wanting to take a risk, you know, enough, just enough to where you won't settle for the ordinary and the safe. But at the same time, you know, it you don't want. You just want to push yourself just enough, you know,
right.
just keep yourself on edge with it. You know, don't settle for the low hanging fruit if you can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is, I think a really, you know, a really valuable lesson when you start feeling like you're dialing it in mm-hmm. and, oh, I can do this behind my back, you know, then I think you're kind of losing something. You're losing a passion. You're losing the healthy fear of your stuff. I read something recently about it's in a book called The War of Art. That's written by a novelist and screenwriter. It's the guy that wrote Bagger Vance, and don't ask me his name because I couldn't summon his name right now at the moment. But he was quoting or using the anecdote of how actors, especially famous actors, choose their roles, why they make the choices of it. And he noted that many actors respond to that question by saying, oh, he was citing on the Actor's Studio, okay. Inside the Actor's Studio.
Okay.
And he said, invariably, they get that answered that question. How do you choose the roles that you do? And what prompts you? And invariably, they answer, "It scared me."
No,
you know,
the good ones.
And yeah. And I chose because it scared me. So translation is that it was something I haven't done before. It was challenging, and I wanted to rise to the occasion. I wanted to meet that challenge. You know, I wanted to do something that I haven't done before.
Right.
You know, and go, you know, boldly go where no man has gone before, you know, with the, be it the Starship Enterprise or your screenplay. You know,
I was up in, until 3:30 last night working because I was scared of, not being able to, wrestle Flash, the program. I'm trying to learn this program, yeah. Flash. And yeah. Like, I don't know it. I'm online. Right. I'm learning as I'm going.
Yeah.
And it's such a high learning curve,
uh-huh.
but it was a challenge. And like, I don't feel necessarily tired because I was motivated all last night
sure.
because this just sheer desire of like, I've got to learn this. I've got to figure this out. How do they do this? And then just because of that desire and wanting to know, mm-hmm. and then getting to that place where you kind of break it, where just like you accomplish it, where you started and where you end up, it's such a far journey, but you're like, wow, I did it. I was kind of scared jumping into it because I didn't know how I was going to get, you know, where to start. But as you finish and you found out you could actually do something or finish a task, yeah. that's always, you know, satisfying.
Yeah.
So I guess for me, that's, so now coming back to you, it's like you have this, you have three scripts that you've abandoned.
Yes.
And
well,
so, right.
Yeah.
So
consciously.
What was the first gig you had that was like where you got paid as a screenwriter?
Well, actually, I got paid to do a rewrite on Slaughter Alley. So what happened was I wrote it then that summer of '82, I think it was, and then. I gave it to a friend of mine who I'd gone to film school with.
Okay.
He's actually a former roommate of mine, Richard Green, who's now a very powerful agent at CAA, actually.
there you go, see?
There you go. And Richard had, at that time, aspirations to be a producer. And so he was working for a true producer, a real working producer.
Real working
and,
producer.
A guy named Bill Finnegan who made TV movies and such.
As opposed to those, you know, who are in Hollywood, there's a lot of producers.
Yes, but, yes, yeah,
but like
true.
A true working
yes,
paid
yes, yeah, same,
produce,
exactly.
producer.
Same, and you can apply that to writers and actors and all of that. I'm going to order another pint here when he comes back again, yeah. but I'm just keeping one eye on him. So what happened was Can I get a
no?
Yeah, okay, but no. I want to go for something a little redder.
A little redder.
Yeah, and the color. You had a nice pour. You were took into someone there.
That's
earlier.
The Nelson O'Reilly the Rye IPA.
Oh, really?
It's an IPA.
Oh, it is an IPA. And is that red? Really?
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting.
You're looking for something that's red, that's going to be maltier.
Yeah. Yeah,
I would recommend getting the Orkney Skull Splitter.
Okay, then. Oh, the Skull Splitter. I've had it, but I've had it in the bottle. You have that in draft?
Yeah,
okay. Oh, you do. Okay, I don't want to go. I want to stick with the draft. Then, do you have the thistle? Yeah. Bring that. Thank you.
Actually, can I just get some water? I just need to get all hydrated here.
So, Richard, I gave the script to Richard because he said, "Let me take this to." The producer I'm working for, Bill Finnegan, and he said, I think he might like it because Richard read it and really liked it and thought, wow, this is cool. And so I said, great. So he took it to his boss, and lo and behold, the boss loved it. And they optioned it from me. And then they.
What was that feeling like?
It's
surreal.
You're through the roof, you know, you're just, it's just an exciting, wonderful feeling. And you could just feel like, wow, I could do this the rest of my life.
Do you have like, is there like a moment of, I don't know, where all of a sudden, like your whole future is right in front of you.
Oh yeah.
You're like, boom, that instance, like.
Yeah.
I'm on my way, and boom, 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 and all this
oh,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You line it up right, real fast. You know, you can just see it. You know, like billboards on the freeway.
Man, how is that?
That's good. That's good. You want to try that?
Yeah. Let me just give it a quick sip. That looks very frothy.
Yeah, it's a nice head on that.
Mm.
So
good beer.
So they optioned it, and then they sat on it for like a year, for one thing or another.
Reality.
Yeah. It just took a while. And then, I think it was that following summer, they called up and said, I think we're going to get some action on this now. We're going to start rolling on it. And I think they renewed the option. They optioned it for 1 year, and I think they renewed the option. And then what happened was they got some money and they asked me to do a rewrite on it. And they had started, they were getting a director and they had Judd Nelson and Alexandra Paul cast.
What year was this?
This
like
was
84?
About 80, no, this is 83.
Oh, so 82. Before Judd Nelson with Judd Nelson.
Yeah.
All right, okay.
Well, we knew who Judd Nelson was.
But the Breakfast Club hadn't come out yet.
He had done. Forget what he had done before that garnered a fair amount of attention.
Okay.
So he was a cool actor.
Right. You know, right.
We all like, oh yeah, that's cool. So what happened was I did the rewrite. I got like $5,000 to do a rewrite on it.
Wow.
And I remember.
And you didn't have an agent at the time, did you?
Well, that, okay.
Quick
aside on that. There's a lot of different things. Slaughter Rally is instructional for those listening in many different ways.
Okay. This is the stuff that people love.
Okay.
They want to know how you got your agent.
First of all, let me roll back. I've literally finished writing the end on Slaughter Rally, the very first draft of it. And I took, because I lived in Westwood at the time, I said, oh, I'm going to go take a walk into the village and, you know, get a cup of coffee or a beer or something like that. And I felt like
celebration.
And, celebrate. So I walked into Westwood Village, which at that time still had bookstores. And I remember going into, it was like Hunter's Books that was there on Westwood Boulevard. And I walked in and prominently displayed on a case. And the whole little setup as you walk in is Stephen King's Christine, which cover of it was the car, you know, and basically the grill of that, I think it was an old Chrysler. And I looked at that and I thought, oh no, don't tell me.
No.
It can't be about like, and it wasn't quite the same, but boy, it was close enough.
It was an old car, I couldn't believe it.
So that, first of all, that was lesson number one, which is that, you know, there are, like you were talking about earlier, there are ideas up there in the cloud that you just sort of take. Well, if you don't act on the idea that you have, somebody else is going to act on it as well.
Right.
And one of my instructors at UCLA used to say that, look, ideas are literally out there floating around in the ether. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon at all for someone or several people to latch on to the same idea at the same time.
Right.
And it's not a case of somebody ripping off someone else or anything. It's just sometimes you all, you can call it the collective unconscious. You can call it any synchronicity. You can call it any number of things. But it is a reality. It happens. So
I'm a testament to that as well.
Yeah. Okay. So my only advice in that front is that it will happen to you sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
And act on your ideas. You get an impulse, you get a creative impulse, then act on it right away, you know, if you can. You know, sometimes it's just not possible. And, you know, and sometimes there's not quite enough of an idea. So that was that. Then, so anyway, I did this rewrite at Slaughter Alley. They were on the fast track. They were going to head into production. Alexander Paul, Judd Nelson starring in it. I was doing this rewrite. I finished the rewrite. I remember this very well on Halloween 1980, I guess it's 83 at that point. And then 2 weeks before they were scheduled to go before cameras, the money disappeared. It evaporated. I forgot to say, we got the proverbial green light after my rewrite on it. Okay. Oh. The green light. They're going forward. It's happening. Boom. I quit my job at the Academy and I was kind of like, so long, mailroom. So long, suckers. You're never going to see me again, you know, except when I'm walking up the red carpet to collect my little gold man.
Slaughter Alley.
That's what I was saying, you know, just after that option, that initial payment of like, wow, I am truly boom. It's just, you can see the billboards on that highway lined up all the way to the horizon, what you're going to do, you know, it's all laid out for you. So then the money is yanked 2 weeks before the start date. It just fell apart. I never got an answer as to why it happened. And suddenly everything came to a screeching, and I mean screeching halt.
Yeah.
So the big payday that I was going to get once they started filming never happened. And so I actually had to go back to the Academy and ask in the most humiliating circumstances, ask for my old job back, which they gave me.
I'm sure they've seen it all.
God love them. But that taught me such a valuable lesson. You know, just such a valuable lesson very early on about the film industry, how volatile it is. And no matter how good it looks or whatever, there are bolts of lightning that can strike at any given moment out there that will just derail even the most soundest of projects. So just always be aware of that. Do not count your chickens before they hatch, because it's just too many things can happen. Until your film is playing before an audience who has paid money to see it in a theater, you know, near you,
doesn't exist.
It does, you know, just keep knocking on wood the whole way. Just be lucky you can even, you know, you've gotten that far. So then in answer to the agent, so when they first made the offer to option it, I was I had no agent. I had no representation at all. So I didn't know what to do. Yeah. So through some friends of good friends of mine, they recommended an agent to me. They made a call to him. And this guy came in and negotiated a deal. And suddenly, and this was another valuable lesson I learned, the figures that they were offering me directly were suddenly twice as high as I after the agent got into the business. So he basically negotiated a better deal for me.
so he can get his cut.
Right. So he certainly got his cut, but he also, you know, they stepped in and they made sure that I wasn't taken advantage of, which, because you know, you're young and you're hungry and you think, I'll take, you know, take anything that they want to want to throw at you. But they, this agent came in, his name was Shelley Weil, and Shelley came in and got that, did a good job on that first deal. However, Shelley wouldn't take me on as a full, as a legitimate client at his agency, because they didn't represent, well, as he would keep me on as what he called a pocket client, which was kind of in his back pocket. But I wasn't a regular client yet based on the merits of a quote-unquote exploitation script. So, you know, Slaughter Alley was still, for him, didn't merit a, you know, real representation yet. So, that's how, so I had, I was his pocket client for a while. And so he wasn't going to do anything for me. He would be there to negotiate a deal for me, but I wasn't going to be able to get out and meet other people and, or move on the success of or the limited success of Slaughter Alley. So what happened was I went back, I had my, took back my job at the mailroom, fell into a deep funk of a depression where I was like Xeroxing my face every day and, you know, because thinking I am never going to get out of here. I'm going to die an old man in the mailroom, you know, and all this stuff. It was just, oh, it was so depressing. And I felt I was never, I wasn't going to find anything worth writing about. And so then what happened, and during this time I was going to all these punk shows and I was starting to make music videos for for Black Flag and Henry Rollins and
what do you say make music Minutemen. Like were you cinematographer, director, part of the crew?
I was I was directing them, you know. Yeah, so I mean, basically, I just was going to these guys. I went to the Minutemen after a show, and I said, I talked to Mike Watt, the bass player, and I said, Mike, you know, I can make a. I had a couple of beers, and I said, Mike, I can make a, video for you, guys, for like, you know, $300. And Mike said, okay, let's do it.
Do you, do you recall any songs, the videos that you've done?
Oh, yeah. It was for the Minutemen, it was This Ain't No Picnic. And then we, in the same session we shot, we went down and they were performing live that night, too. We were shooting on a weekend. And so we shot on a Saturday and Sunday. And then they were performing Saturday night at a big punk rock show down at the Olympic Auditorium in downtown L.A., which used to be a an arena for, like, you know, old wrestling gigs and stuff like that. It was just a concrete slab. And so we had all the camera equipment and everything, and I had the crew, and we were all young. I said, look, I'll pay everybody, you know, we'll you guys, let's get some pizza and let's go down to the frickin' show and we'll
shoot pizza. What'd you shoot?
And we'll shoot. I said, I want to shoot them doing this Ain't Talking About Love, which was their cover of the Van Halen opus. You know, Van Halen's first big hit, Ain't Talking About Love. And when, you know, when Van Halen performed it, it's like 6 minutes long, and then it finally climaxes with, you know, hey, you know, and that whole, the Minutemen did it in 37 seconds. And they basically, they just took the last stanza of lyrics. And then, you know, I've been to the edge. I stood and looked down, you know, I lost a lot of friends there. I got no time to mess around. No way. And then, hey, you know, hey, and that was it. And they played it really fast. So I told the Minutemen, I said, let's do this live. You know, I mean, I'm going to shoot you guys live performing this, but try to perform it at the tempo you remember recording it, because we had no playback, really.
Right.
You know,
no,
I had a cassette of a song that I was playing back for the stuff earlier in the day. And so, and they said, okay. And I said, do one other thing. The song is so short, just play it twice. So I have time to switch camera positions, because I had two cameras. And I said, I just want my two guys to switch, you know, angles so we can get full on coverage. And he said, sure, you know, we'll do it. So we get down there, and it's this big punk show. There's like half a dozen bands on there, but they were pretty high up in the order. And so we were there and we were right on the edge of the proscenium, and they had all the camera stuff in there. And they told me where it was going to be in their set, you know. And so I said, okay. And they gave me the signal, and I said, roll the cameras. Then they started playing the song. and the guys were shooting, and then the song ended 37 seconds later, and I said, great, now we're going to switch positions. They just went right back into it without any break, and I said, Mike, no, you know, give me a break. And D. Boone, you know, on the guitar, was just, I remember him just kind of shrugging, like, oh, hey, sorry, man. Dude, you know, rock and roll,
punk rock.
So I had my good friend Bill Judkins was doing second unit, right. Which was basically, he had an old spring wound Bell and Howell 16 millimeter camera that was like the leftover from World War I or something, you know. and Bill was right next to me, and I remember he just scrambled up onto the stage. He just clambered up there right away, and as soon as they started doing the second version, and got behind them, looking out at the audience, nice. And got a great angle. My other friend John Hart couldn't do it because the camera was too big. He just couldn't get it up. It was an Aeroflex, and so Bill got these great shots, but the problem was that Bill's camera was so old. The spring on the camera is it would get lower in the wind, it would start slowing down. Mm-hmm. So when the film starts moving slower through the aperture, you capture more action on each frame. So basically, when you project it, everything starts speeding up. It's like an old silent film,
right?
You know,
right.
And so the last footage bits of them, they're just like jumping around. They look like, you know, Buster Keaton.
Crazy.
It was crazy. But once we started cutting it together, it kind of added to the whole frenetic quality of the video. And then we did some in this, because it was early 80s, we could solarize some video and stuff. And so we added some kind of effects to it. And it's I have it on my website. You can see it.
I gotta check it out.
Yeah, but MTV played it as the world's shortest video. It made the MTV news. I never saw that, but apparently Kurt Loder introduced it as the world's shortest video at the time,
which is
something like that. What I thought was pretty cool. But this ain't no picnic. The one that we really did that was sort of legitimate, that played quite a while on MTV, and actually a lot of that footage, all the outtakes and everything else were proved to be pretty valuable, because, you know, D. Boone, the guitarist for the Minutemen, was killed in a car wreck late in the December of that year. This is 84. And, you know, it's great having some really good, great images of him performing, although we don't have sound on it. But there's some really crisp stuff. And then I did another one for them. Later that year, King of the Hill, which we shot on video at the time, and we had a Steadicam for that. We really stepped up, you know. So
you did all this stuff. You know, so you were what doors did that open for you?
Well,
do you think that or that you saw on top of your writing? All right, sorry, we're back. Okay, so you're making punk rock videos.
Yeah, so what I was my idea at the time was like, okay, cool. I'm getting some directing experience now doing these music videos, you know. And it was real shoestring budget kind of stuff.
Rock.
It was totally punk rock. But SST Records was really happy with the Minutemen videos, and so they started talking to me about doing something with Black Flag.
That was pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was, because Black Flag basically ran SST.
Right. At the time, it was Henry Rollins was head of it, wasn't he?
Wasn't
the original? My memory's old.
Black Flag was always Greg Ginn, and Chuck Dukowski, but then Chuck eventually left. And just continued to sort of run SST, but Greg Ginn started SST Records, and he was the guitarist for Black Flag.
Okay.
And so Henry, was not the original.
Yeah, no.
Vocalist. There were several before Henry, but he was the one that finally stepped in and became really the face of Black Flag, because Henry really relished, I think, being the front man there.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, a formidable personality. And so
Who formed the Circle Jerks after that?
Well, Chris Morris, and he would been Chris Morris was the original vocalist for Black Flag,
right? Okay,
and then he sang on like Nervous Breakdown and some of those really that very first EP 45s that they did. Then he went on to he left and to start Circle Jerks.
I was up at Skywalker Sound a couple years ago.
Uh huh.
And they had a project there. They had all the original masters for the Black Flag, albums.
That really?
They were remastering.
Oh, wow.
And it was just classic. Like, it was box they were showing us, this project they were working on. I'm just like...
That's interesting.
Crazy. Black Flag meets Skywalker Ranch.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, there's a clash of stuff right there. But... and that's another story working with okay. Henry and all that. But you know, I was hoping that what this would do would give me continued cred,
mm-hmm.
you know, as a director, and then my writing career would be kind of moving along simultaneously,
right.
You know, with this, so that eventually I could parlay it into a thing where I write something and say, okay, I want to direct this. Okay, and hoping that somebody would give me that option, would give me that chance. What happened then was that I'm back at the mailroom, right, and I'm like in a funk now because the production fell apart, and I just didn't think I was going to get anywhere out. So like I was saying, I've seen all these punk shows and really be inspired by the music, and that's when I really tried to write that failed murder mystery thing mm-hmm. that fell apart, and it just didn't come together. So I also started a record label shortly after this too.
Wow.
but that was a little further down the line, but so anyway, still in working there, I ran into another old friend of mine that I'd gone to film school with.
There you go.
And he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm licking stamps in the mailroom, dude. I'm like bummed. And he said, well, whatever happened to Slaughter Alley? He said, that was a great script. And I said, I'm just sitting there on a shelf. And he said, give it to me. He said, I'm working in the mailroom at the William Morris Agency. And he said, oh, you know, I can't tell you the crap I have to read every day. And a lot of this is a lot of the scripts are by people who are making a lot of money. He said, that Slaughter Alley is just as good as any of the stuff that I'm reading. So let me get it to a couple of young agents there that I have in mind. And I said, okay. So he did. And within a couple of weeks, I was asked to come into William Morris, and I met with a couple of young agents there. Rick Jaffe and Carol Yumpkus were their names. And they loved the script and they signed me. That was just like, boy, suddenly it was like, oh, well, being represented by people my age, whereas Shelley Weil was a very old, much older guy.
There you go.
And now here were people that like in my age bracket speaking my language, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they just loved it. And they said, we're going to get you out of meetings and we're going to start finding some things for you. And I said, fantastic. So I was really emboldened by that. Rick Jaffa, incidentally, left a couple of years, or three years or 4 years later, is my agent, to become a writer himself. And he and his wife just recently wrote Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he's done all right.
Okay.
You know? And But he was a terrific guy and a terrific agent, you know, for me at the time. And I remember meeting him the first time, and he said, I got to tell you, I said, I got your script. I read it. I couldn't put it down. He said, when it was done, I threw it in the air. I was so happy reading a really good script. This is a really awesome script. I love it. You know, and this was just like, oh, God, thank you. Hearing stuff like that
right.
from somebody really in the know.
Yeah.
You know, who says, oh, we're going to take this and we're going to get you some work, you know, based off of it. It was still under option with the company that so it was tied up. They couldn't go out and try to resell it, but they said, we're going to use this as a calling card for you and get you out there now and start.
Well, there you go.
Yeah. And start, you know, things. So that's what led to my first bit of employment, which I can tell you about now, or we'll hold until next time.
We'll take it later. I think we'll wrap it up for tonight.
Okay.
I think this is great. This is better than I expected, but I mean, cause it's, I feel like there's so much more we could talk about. And I think that the audience of one, whoever's listening to this podcast, Yeah. You get a real good kick out of it.
Okay.
But, yeah, so let's wrap it up. And then we'll catch up another, you know, week
sure.
or so.
We've kind of jumped around all over the place with music and
yeah, but it's good. It's still good stuff.
Let me finish a thought, though, which was maybe you can put this back into the context that it really should have been in. When I was earlier talking about going to the shows and like seeing the blasters and a lot of this rockabilly stuff that was happening, they struck me all as being a little bit like posers.
Right.
And I felt very acutely that, you know, there would have been a generation or two before them who were the real McCoys, if you will.
Right.
That were the real rockabilly guys, the guys who were sniffing glue and racing their cars at 3 o'clock in the morning and, like, you know, drinking. They got a pint of slow gin in the back pocket in high school, you know, and would rumble with a chain and a tire
iron. Right.
And I always was thinking about, boy, it'd be really, it's amusing to, what would happen if some of those guys came and met up with these kind of poser rockabilly pussies, you know, and really come to rumble. What would happen? You know, what would happen to these kind of posing guys who look like really tough?
Right.
You know, if the real McCoys showed up one night on their doorstep. So that was kind of an impetus to start writing Slaughter Alley. It was
interesting.
Like, really, what would happen if the past came and visited upon the future?
Yeah.
And how would either hold up, you know?
That is cool. And it's such a cool little subculture. Like Conan, Conan O'Brien is a huge rockabilly fan. He's got his own rockabilly band, and you know.
Oh, really? I didn't know that was his brand of music.
Oh, yeah. He goes sometimes on these little tours, like when there's a hiatus of a show, where he and his little rockabilly band play across the, you know, country.
Sure.
So, but he's got this affinity. That's probably why his hair is a pompadour all the time or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that sort of explains a lot.
He's a Harvard guy, whatever he is, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting. Huh.
It'd be funny if he met up with the past. No.
Well, that's kind of what I'm talking about, you know.
So,
you know, you look at it. I mean, again, it's partly of our fascination with people like Johnny Cash and Carl Perkins and all those early guys. You know, they weren't bright, educated guys.
No.
They were tough as nails, though, and they were the real deal. And so I just, you know, I always just kind of wonder what would happen. So
how funny. All right, cool.
Yeah.
We can wrap this up and then we'll continue another time for sure. And I know I'm interested. There's so much more to talk about. So, and then hopefully the next time we talk, I'll mention whatever the next steps of projects are going on and we'll catch up with what you're doing.
Yeah, there was kind of a cluster of activity there at a period there that really, you know, career in Hollywood is very streaky. It can be like a hot streak in sports, you know, where if you're hot and you're working it, then work it, you know, surf that wave, you know,
like that.
Because,
yeah.
Because you never know if another good one is going to come or not.
Right.
Know, again, things Hollywood is always throwing the change-up ball at you. So I'm mixing my sports metaphors. I know, you know, I got about three or four of them in the span of two or three sentences here, but I think you get the gist of what I'm talking about.
I like it. You lost me on the wave when I was just, my brain started thinking about the wave. Okay,
good. Yeah.
Well, all right, cool.
Okay.
Well,
all right, Scott. Thank you.
Yeah. We'll catch up later.
Cool.
I hope you enjoyed going inside the mind of Randall Jansen. We will be going back in over the next few episodes. If you want links to anything we spoke about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/014. And if you like the show, please subscribe and leave us a review on Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, Spreaker, wherever you listen to the show. Head over to screenwritersmind.com. Thank you for listening. And as always, write, rewrite, sell, repeat. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Screenwriter's Mind with Alex Ferrari at screenwritersmind.com. And for more great filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.